Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Hey, I hear the heat's breaking. God bless you. I hope everybody made it through okay with the heat. It's only in the 90s here in El Cajon, and we're usually in the hundreds right now. So my sympathies go out to those who suffered through a really tough weekend. Hope you're feeling all right. I hope you're getting a lot of water. But I did hear on the news today, it seems to be breaking all along the eastern part of the country. So thank God for that. I teased at the end of the last hour that our guest this hour would be better than Joe Heschmeyer, our guest last hour. And in case that seemed rude, our guest this hour is Joe Heschmeyer. So
I just want to apologize to all the guests who are hoping for someone better. All the listeners, I mean, their hopes were up, and now they're just dashed. It's more of me.
Right. We just changed the topic because we want to. Joe's an expert in these early church things, and so we have another early church kind of topic for the second hour, and that is about the popes in the early church. And you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. The papacy in the early church is our topic. And since I already introduced my guest last hour, I'll give him just a quick introduction this hour. He's a lawyer, former seminarian, now a married man, and works at the School of Faith. He's also the guy behind the blog Shameless Popery, which this is just a great name. But also you have a podcast as well as the blog, Joe.
Which I think, if memory serves, you hate the name of the podcast because it is The Catholic Podcast.
Yeah, that's I'm sorry, I fell asleep there for a minute. That the name of your podcast is so boring.
But well, let me just say, Brandon Vaught of Word on Fire gave us the suggestion for that name. He said, "Hey, this name's still open," and it was like no one had even thought to take the name. So
yeah, maybe leave it for the Pope. That's what the rest of us were thinking. But no, you just
don't
jumped
you own Catholic.com?
Shh, quiet. Brandon Vaught, a fine man, and that's a great ministry they have over there. What's the name of that crazy bishop they got in charge of all that? What's that guy's
yeah,
name?
Bishop Robert something.
Robert something,
I think
he's
the baron of something.
That's right. Very fine bishop. What a lot of good people. There's so much good stuff going on in Catholic media, and Joe Heschmeyer, a part of it. And this hour, we'll go back to the early church and the papacy in the early church. Many people will maybe say things like, well, you know, there probably was some leader of the Church of Rome. It's not even clear that Peter ever went to Rome. I'm giving you some of the criticisms of the papacy.
Oh, yeah.
If Peter was in Rome, it Paul seems to have had the more prominent role or something. This idea of the papacy, really, it's just an idea that develops later because Rome is the kind of the capital there of the empire. And it's just one of those things that those Catholics, they added on to the simple, clean, and beautiful faith handed on by Jesus. This is an accretion that the Catholics imposed on Christianity. And frankly, just because everyone respected the Pope and listened to the Pope for 1,500 years doesn't mean we need a Pope. And thank God for Luther and Calvin and Zwingli and all the rest who came along and got rid of that institution. And along comes our guest this hour, Joe Heschmeyer, to say, nope, that is not true.
Yeah, that's all I'm going to say. Just no, I disagree. I think that's all wrong.
As a matter of fact, what was the papacy in the early church? What was its condition? How did it function? And did they use a word like papacy? And did they really respect this Bishop of Rome? Or what's the deal?
Yeah, okay. So I think a good place to start with the conversation is actually Luke 22. I don't know a lot of people who start there, but I think that's the right place to start. Because the apostles are at the Last Supper with Jesus, and they're doing what they do best. They're arguing about which of them is the greatest. And in the past, Jesus has answered in terms of a spiritual greatness and in terms of sanctity. So he tells them to be childlike in their faith. He takes the kid and he puts the kid in their midst. But now they're arguing again, and it seems like they have in mind authority within the kingdom to come. And Jesus responds fittingly. He says, you know, the Gentiles give themselves these grand lofty titles. They call themselves benefactors, and they lord their authority over the ones they rule. And he says, it's not to be so among you. Instead, let the greatest among you be like the youngest, and the one who rules like the one who serves. But he does talk about there the one who rules. So there is a recognition of authority and a total change in how we understand the way authority ought to be exercised in the church. And then immediately after this, he tells all 12 that they're going to have a heavenly kingdom, sharing his own kingship, sitting on thrones in the kingdom, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And then he says to one of them, "Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift all of you as wheat, but I prayed for you," and that's in the singular, "Simon, that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned back, strengthen your brothers." So why is that so critical? Because he's just said Christian leadership is a call to serve others, and that all 12 are called to have that role within the church, but that one of them is called to have that role in relationship to the other 11. That's it in a nutshell. That's the papacy. This is where we get what I think is the best papal title, which is servant of the servants of God.
Okay, so, if I may, to be fair to the Protestant critic of the papacy or the Orthodox or the worldly critic or whoever, even if you say, well, it's obvious in the scripture that Peter has the preeminent role among the apostles. Jesus has clearly singled him out time and time again and given him a special vocation. And his role in the Gospels is bigger than all the other apostles combined. Okay, all that. That doesn't make him a pope. You know, pope is something that comes later.
So a pope comes from the word papa. It just means father. So it's a recognition of being a spiritual father. It's not even, strangely enough, it's not even an official title of the Bishop of Rome. It's just kind of more of a colloquial title. There are plenty of official titles of the Bishop of Rome, like Servant of the Servants of God. But Pope is more of a nickname than a title in a real sense. But it is a true recognition of a real role. So there's a reason why we call the Bishop of Rome by this, partly to delineate that something special is going on with him. You know, like you said, there's two ways of viewing Peter's role. One is to say, well, he's the same as all the other 11, but just has like slightly more tasks given to him by Jesus or something. But in reality, we don't just see a natural leadership. We see him actually being called to have a role even in relation to the other 11. And there's no equivalent where none of the other 11, in other words, are told, you need to take care of Peter, you need to servant lead over the other 11, anything like that. It's really specific to Peter. And we find, even at the resurrection, we're told, you know, go tell Peter and the others. And so all over the place, Peter is singled out for this role. So then the question becomes, well, does that pass on?
Yes, right.
Right. Well, I think at the very least, starting the conversation, you'd say, wouldn't the presumption be that if God, who works through a single head all over the place with Adam and Eve, with every family, with the patriarchs, with the judges, with the kings, all over the place, he has this same triangular model of governance where there's one head who's ultimately accountable for the fate of the people. And then we get to the apostles, and he seems to do the exact same thing, even while he's on earth, when that role is less needed than at any other point in history. And we're to believe, after Peter died, Jesus wanted it to switch to a totally different, never before used in the history of the world, democratic or other kind of style of church leadership. It just is, the burden of proof would seem to be on the person who said, Christ did all of this stuff, but meant for the exact opposite to be the case after the death of the apostles.
Yeah.
So I would start there.
Yeah, right. That Jesus shows all the signs of establishing something here, and then what, it just disappears. It's supposed to just disappear after the death of the last apostle. It would be very strange indeed. But I know there are many people who want to talk to you about this. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. The papacy in the early church is our topic this hour. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. If you think Catholics are all wrong about this papacy thing, you are welcome to call. If you think we're all right about that, but you have a question or you'd like some help explaining something, you are welcome welcome to call. 888-318-7884 is the number. And sometimes delightful things happen here. And when we went to the break, I stepped out in the hall, and who's out in the hall? The author of the wonderful memoir, Sunday Will Never Be the Same, Dawn Eden Goldstein. She's a rock and roll journalist, kind of a religious seeker and searcher who finally found her way to the Catholic Church and writes all about it in the beautiful memoir, Sunday Will Never Be the Same. Well, guess what? She's close. She's finishing up her book tour tonight here in San Diego. So if you want to meet Dawn Eden Goldstein tonight at Our Lady's Gifts, on Columbia Street here in San Diego, at Our Lady of the Rosary Parish. Come out, meet Dawn, and get your signed copy of her bestseller, Sunday Will Never Be the Same.
Got questions? Visit us today at Catholic.com.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God.
My husband was affected by Agent Orange and passed away last year. He and I were both Catholic. We both left the church, and I was his caregiver for, the last 5 years, although he was sicker for beyond that. And it did shake up my world. After he passed away, I realized I could go anywhere, and I came back to the church.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
When Paul the Apostle wants to brag about how tough he is, he says, "I said right to Peter's face," which suggests a pretty special role for Peter. If you'd like to talk with us about that role, Peter's role in the early church, and also the role of Peter's successors in the early church, 888-318-7884. I do think there is a general kind of idea about history that many modern people, especially young people, have, Joe Heschmeyer, our guest. And that is that really, look, before about 1945 or something, there's really not that good of records. We're all pretty much guessing about what happened before. And so the idea that is an actual history, that there are actual historical records of the popes and who followed Peter in Rome is just foreign to them. And so I think it's that makes it kind of easy to say, well, this is something that the church made up. The church wanted power, or the church wanted status, or just people wanted to have structures and they couldn't stand all the freedom that Jesus had given them, so they invented this pope thing. But really, there is quite a bit of documentation from the early church.
There is. And interestingly, not even just from Orthodox Christians. You can often find documents from non-Christians that still shed a little bit of light about what Christianity looked like. So yeah, this idea that the early church, we have like no records and no one really knows, or maybe like the church just destroyed all of the rival accounts of Christianity, like none of that stands up to the slightest bit of historical scrutiny. Within a very short period of time, Christianity was spread from as far west as about Spain to as far east as about India, and people wrote, and they took their faith seriously. They took theological debate seriously. And a lot of those documents we still have today, and they give a strong case for the Catholic claim.
Again, 888-318-7884 is the number. I don't want to leave people waiting, as I did a bit the last hour. I just really enjoy talking to Joe Heschmeyer, so I kind of hog the phone. But let's go to Trooper in Marble Falls, Texas, listening on 88.5 FM. Trooper, your question for Joe.
Yeah, Cy and Joe, I just don't think that there were really in many bad popes. They like to go on about some bourgeois or something, but the fact that nobody's taught heresy or gotten too far out of line ought to give us hope.
Yeah, absolutely, Trooper. The Catholic claim is such that that if you could find some really clear instance in which a pope taught something that was like obviously heretical in his capacity as pope on faith and morals, like what the Catholic claim is, you could discredit Catholicism so quickly. And yet there's more than a billion Catholics. So that should give anyone who thinks that history is on their side a little bit of pause, like, wait, maybe these billion people aren't all fools. Maybe there's not some sort of easy silver bullet against papacy. Now, I want to say a word on papal infallibility, because I think it's often misunderstood. Popes can get plenty of things wrong in their private capacity. They can even, like, personally be heretics, but they can't teach it as the teaching of the Catholic Church. The reason is because papal infallibility is not about protecting them. It's about protecting us. You know, in Galatians 5, St. Paul lists the kind of sins that will keep you out of the kingdom of God. And one of them is schism. He also says factions. And in John 17, Jesus calls for us all to be one. Well, heresy is also the kind of sin that keeps you out of heaven. So the whole reason for papal infallibility is because God is ensuring that we never have to choose between being part of the church and being Orthodox, because it forces us into a catch-22 in that situation. We'd have to choose either heresy or schism, and both are damnable sins. So Protestantism has this problem where they believe that they're forced to choose unity or truth, heresy or schism. And both of those are options that are clearly do-not-do kind of options. So infallibility ends up being the only logical way of keeping the church out of error. And this is why we don't see any pope putting us in a situation where we have to affirm heresy to remain Catholic.
Yeah. And Joe, to put him on a happy note, tell him what the pope said to Napoleon.
There's a cardinal that was said to have said, if we couldn't destroy the church and 1800 years, what luck do you think you're going to have?
Right. That wasn't a pope, though. That was a French cardinal whose name is escaping me. But thanks very much, Trooper, for that call. I want to keep moving because a lot of folks want to talk about the pope, and that's good. Let's move now to Anastasia. I don't have a location for you, Anastasia, but I'm delighted that you're here. Your question for Joe Heschmeyer.
Yes. My location is I'm up in the mountains of Pennsylvania, and I might lose
the Poconos?
My connection to you. Near there, yes. My question is, on the timeline of church history, in 1054, the great, I'm not saying it correctly, perhaps, schism occurred.
Schism.
And I believe that was when the Pope was installed in 1054. And could you explain that to me, why the part of the Western Catholic Church, for example, in Egypt and Russia and Greek and I think Armenian, or those folks out there, could you explain to me why they never accepted the Pope and why they did not follow Rome?
Yeah, those are good questions. So the Great Schism is the split between East and West. Usually they say 1054 for when it happened. It's actually a little more complicated than that. There were a series of mutual excommunications in 1054. That then kind of boiled over into a broader schism, frankly. There's a whole lot of history that I have to go into to explain why the East and West grew apart. They were speaking different languages. All of the power in terms of a worldly sense was in the East. The West had been largely overrun by barbarians, and so a lot of people in the East were annoyed at having to spiritually submit to a barbarian-run West. You also have these theologians who aren't communicating with each other because they're speaking different languages. So we kind of start going off track in different directions. And so a lot of seemingly insignificant issues, like whether to use leaven or unleavened bread in the Eucharist, end up becoming like big flashpoints for these complicated political, ethnic, religious kind of fights. But it's not true the papacy started in 1054. In fact, I would point you to Against Heresies from 220, in which St. Irenaeus of Lyon traces the history of the papacy up to his own day. He names by name each of the 13 popes and talks about how it's important for everyone to remain in communion with the Bishop of Rome. You can also find in ecumenical church councils, for example, when Pope Leo writes what's called the Tome of Leo, which is a theological intervention in the council, they receive it and say, Peter has spoken. And even after 1054, in what's called the Council of Florence, the East and the West, and I mean here both the Eastern Orthodox and the Armenian Orthodox and the Coptic Orthodox, get together and they sign in an ecumenical council recognized by all the patriarchs that the Pope is head of the church, is one of the many things that was agreed to. That ends up briefly bringing union, at least on paper. But a lot of people on the ground refuse to respect the ecumenical council, even though the emperor, the patriarch of Constantinople, all the patriarchs and the Pope said yes. A lot of people in the East said no, and so the council became a sort of dead letter. I don't know if you're familiar with the famous church, the Hagia Sophia in Turkey. By the time it was taken over by Muslims in the 15th century, it was actually back in union with the Roman Catholic Church.
But even today, there's not a blanket rejection among Orthodox Christian people of the papacy, but there is a sense that the role that the Latin Church, for example, gives to the Pope is not the actual role that Christ is given. It would be more of a first among equals than it would be as the governor, the direct governor of the church.
Right. You'll sometimes hear Orthodox critics say that the Bishop of Rome is the first among equals, or they'll say he had a primacy of honor. Recognizing him to be first in any sense is important because it shows that the Catholic claim, it's not just like coming from nowhere. But secondly, the primacy of honor is based on kind of a misunderstanding that honor in the early church was used as a shorthand for office. And we see this not just in Christian writings, but even Plato speaks about the honor of office and talks about aristocracy as the positions of honor being held. So to say a primacy of honor isn't just he gets to go first in a procession. It's actually like a primacy of office. But because we don't hear that when we hear the word honor anymore, it's led to a lot of misunderstandings about what the early Christians taught in both the East and in the West.
But it would be fair to say to Anastasia that the Protestant rejection of the papacy is of a different nature than the Orthodox distinction about the role of the papacy. These are two different things. Anastasia?
Explaining that, I appreciate your time.
Thank you very, very much. Appreciate your time as well. Was my phrasing poor there, or is that reasonable to say, Joe? That
No, I think that's a really good way. That I think there's often this... I've seen Orthodox criticize themselves for taking Catholic arguments against Protestants and Protestant arguments against Catholics. But I think a true Orthodox response to the papacy is going to be a lot more nuanced than simply what you might find from like a Sola Scriptura Protestant.
Let's go to Daniel in New Jersey, watching on YouTube Live. Daniel, your question for Joe Heschmeyer.
Hi, Joe. Thank you so much for taking the time to take my question. Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you just fine. Thanks for calling in.
Excellent. So my question is a little bit nuanced. It's basically, I've read Upon This Rock and other, great works of that sort. And my question is the evidence for papal succession, from your perspective, merely circumstantial? In other words, even if we were to assume that Irenaeus and others, were arbiters of the matter, would that necessarily, suggest that papal succession, as we currently conceive of it, is something that we...
We missed it a little bit there at the end. It faded out on us, but you get the general idea.
I do get the general idea. It's a good question. I would say a few things to that. So he mentioned Irenaeus. I want to quote Irenaeus just so people know what he's talking about. Irenaeus, I said earlier 220. I was actually wrong. It's like 180 AD. So this is extremely early in the history of the church. To put it in context, the word Trinity is first used to describe the Godhead in 181 AD. So this is actually before the word Trinity is being used in the way we use it now. Says that he says, quote, that tradition derived from the apostles of the very great, the very ancient and universally known church founded and organized at Rome by the two most glorious apostles, Peter and Paul. Then he says, it's a matter of necessity that every church should agree with this church on account of its preeminent authority. So he's pointing to Rome specifically, saying it's founded by Peter and Paul, and every church needs to agree with this church. And then he traces in the next chapter every bishop of Rome, every pope.
Joe, I'm sorry, I got to interrupt you for a quick second. We'll finish with Irenaeus. We'll come back on the other side. And also with the question about, well, isn't this evidence just circumstantial? Right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Bishop James Conley of the Diocese of Lincoln. Keep it right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" Turns out that today, as back then, this question has a lot of different answers. So many groups want to appropriate Jesus, tweaking his identity until he looks and sounds just like one of them. But then you no longer have the Lord, says apologist Trent Horn. You have an imposter. In his new groundbreaking book, Counterfeit Christ, Trent exposes 18 phony versions of Jesus that we encounter today, helping you to recognize the fakes when you see them, explain why they're phony, and make a case for the full truth and beauty of who Jesus is, the Christ, the Son of the living God. Order your copy of Counterfeit Christ today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Love and beauty. As a little girl, Dawn Eden Goldstein knew she wanted those things, that in them, somehow, she would find God. Over the years, as a rock journalist, she moved among some of popular music's best-known artists, straining to capture that transcendent love and beauty in every note and lyric. In Sunday Will Never Be the Same, Dawn recounts her spiritual journey in beautifully wrought detail, mixing powerful accounts of trauma, healing, and epiphany with funny anecdotes from inside the music scene. It is the rare conversion story that delights as it inspires, amuses as it edifies, and ultimately lays before the reader a lived testimony to the transforming grace of Christ. Order your copy of Sunday Will Never Be the Same by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
I'm Gloria Purvis.
And I'm Deacon Harold. The Morning Glory team talks about racism in modern society.
Tomorrow morning, 7 Eastern. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Had a little trouble with the connection there with Daniel in New Jersey, but I think we got Daniel back. Daniel, want to just restate your question real quick, and we'll let Joe continue with his answer.
Absolutely. So the question is, we know that there are good historical reasons to believe that early Christians, such as Irenaeus, asserted that there was a primacy of Rome and that there was what we're currently qualifying as papal succession. My question was, is this merely quote-unquote circumstantial evidence? And I guess as a sub-point of that, even if we, you know, assume these historical records to be true, how does that necessarily mean that what they're saying is true? In other words, it might be true that historical people made claims, but how can we know that those claims are in fact accurate?
Yeah, that's a I love that question. It's a great question. I think that's very well worded. I think a few things. Number one, at the end of the day, if we don't trust the early Christians after the time of the New Testament, then we can't trust the New Testament, because these same people are the ones who tell us which books belong. It doesn't mean they're right about every jot and tittle. It doesn't mean they're right about every single claim they make. But it does mean that we generally trust what they have to say. Two, I think this also is important from the perspective of Scripture. So I would turn your attention to Hebrews 13. There's several references in there to leadership, but specifically in verse 17, they say, whoever Paul or whoever wrote it says, obey your leaders and submit to them, for they're keeping watch over your souls as men who have to give account. Let them do this joyfully and not sadly, for that would be of no advantage to you. Now, this is a point that should be clear, but is worth making explicit. Jesus is clear about the distinction between shepherds and sheep. And there are certain men who are chosen as shepherds. And we see in Acts that they go around and choose other men to be shepherds. It's not a democratic election. They go through and appoint those that they think are qualified. We see in Paul's letter to Timothy that he says, don't be hasty in the laying on of hands. So that there's an actual spiritual duty that the apostles and those with them in these levels of like bishops have of choosing other qualified men to be shepherds. Because the minute you leave it up to the sheep to vote, then they're going to vote for whoever kind of does what they want. And then the whole relationship between shepherd and sheep gets inverted. It would be like if every year, every 5 years, kids got to vote to keep or replace their parents. That would totally disrupt the relationship of authority between parents and kids. Not a great analogy, but I think you can kind of see what I mean. So the whole question then becomes, if Scripture says obey your leaders, there has to be some way of knowing who, in the eyes of God, is my leader. Do I just choose them? Because if so, I'm ultimately obeying myself. I'm obeying the leader I like, and probably the reason I like them is because they say things I want to hear. Or is there another process? And we see that other process in embryonic form in the book of Acts, where you see the apostles appointing bishops, and we see this this promise to keep, to train them so they can lay hands on other people. That's what apostolic succession is. And this is, you know, a variation of that is papal succession.
Daniel, how does that strike you?
I think that's a very strong answer. I think I hope this isn't too outside the bounds of the question as I initially put it. But where I don't know if other listeners would think this way. What that naturally makes me think is, well, then what is the nature of, you know, that authority? Is it, or the nature of the succession as you've defended it? In other words, you know, there are various claims that are made about authority as we understand it today, you know, that we're supposed to conform to it, that we're supposed to not teach it improperly so as to not scandalize others and so forth. And so, you know, it really does, to me, beg the question, well, okay, let's assume that everything you just said is true. How do we know that it's qualitatively similar to how it's currently understood today? And I suppose that gets into the broader issue of the development of doctrine, which might be beyond the scope of what you're trying to address.
Why don't I give a short answer to that? Cause I think, okay. I think a full answer would take a long time. But Jesus says that he will not leave us orphans at the Last Supper. He says the gates of hell won't prevail against the church. And there are numerous promises. So, for example, in John 17, when he prays explicitly not only for the apostles, but for those who believe through their testimony, that is us, that we'd all be one, this should be recognized as a prayer for unity within the church. All of that only makes sense if we can trust that God isn't going to let the whole process go off the rails. So we don't have to worry about, like, I need to read every historical document between the first century and now and see if there's some, like, hidden gem that totally knocks out the papacy. Like, no, just trust Jesus. The gates of hell won't prevail. And that when you can point to a church and say, like, I can tell you when Lutheranism was invented. I can tell you when Calvinism was invented, or Mormonism, or any of these other isms. But if you say, when was Catholicism started? Well, now you have to go back to Jesus. And that means that's the church I can trust. The gates of hell won't overcome.
Daniel, thanks very, very much for that call. Appreciate it. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. Our number is 888-318-7884. And we're talking about the papacy in the early church today. If you have questions about the papacy, the role of the popes, starting with Peter, And moving through the others, all of whom we can name, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. If you are among those who would say the Catholic teaching that there even is a pope is a suspect teaching, you're also welcome to call 888-318-7884. Up next is Jason in Greenville, South Carolina, listening on 1300 AM. Jason, your question for Joe.
All right, thank you. Thank you, guys. It's good to speak with you. Real quick, I grew up here in Greenville as a Protestant Christian in a Pentecostal holiness household under the leadership of my grandfather, who was Pentecostal holiness, and we moved on to the Baptist church. So I grew up very anti-Catholic. I was on my way to be a Baptist minister. I started studying history and New Testament together, and found the Apostolic Church, the one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church.
Oh, praise God.
But I am a member of the Eastern Orthodox faith. And my question with Peter is, even as early in the book of Acts, when Peter and Paul had a disagreement up north with the Gentiles over circumcision, I believe they were brought back to Jerusalem under James, being the first bishop of Jerusalem, to decide that matter. And then that matter kind of went against Peter's way. And, you know, Paul prevailed and said, you know, the Gentiles did not have to be circumcised. The second part of that question is, then they went to Antioch, and I believe Peter was the first bishop of Antioch before he went to Rome. So why would that change? Why would Antioch not have a higher presence?
Okay, so if Peter was wrong about circumcision, that would seem to suggest undermine this idea that he was the authority. And if Peter was the bishop of Antioch before even going to Rome, and we don't even have a record in the scripture of him being the bishop of Rome, then how can we claim that he's the Pope of Rome?
All right, let's go for both. These are both really good questions. I love your journey. I love your openness to chasing the truth where you can find it, Jason. So to set the record straight, Peter wasn't wrong about circumcision in the book of Acts. He's actually the first. He goes to Cornelius in Acts 10. He dines with an uncircumcised Gentile. He eats food that's richly impure for the Jews. And it's the first hint that we have that the old dietary laws and some of the ritual laws of the Old Testament are no longer in binding force. So that happens in Acts 10. He receives a special revelation from God. There's a great line where he has a dream in which there's like a, almost imagine like a picnic blanket coming down with a bunch of different like pork and everything else. And it says slaughter and eat. And it's, it warms my heart. Well, in Acts 11, he has to defend himself to the Pharisees or like Pharisaical Christians who say, so Acts 11:3, why do you go to uncircumcised men and eat with them? So in Acts 15, when there is the Council of Jerusalem, Peter and Paul are on the same side. It's some of the followers of James who live in Jerusalem, who grew up in a largely Jewish environment, who are really scandalized by all these Gentiles who are coming into the church, and they don't look like, they don't live like Jews do. They're saying, what's the deal? What do we do here? So Peter and Paul are on the same side. Peter actually gives the testimony that's accepted at Acts 15. James confirms it. Now, I think there's a lot of debate about, well, you know, Peter speaks first, James speaks last. What do we make of it? It's an ecumenical council. You know, like we have those today in the church. The authority of the Pope doesn't get rid of ecumenical councils. In fact, this is a much more nuanced historical argument, but without the Pope, you can't know which are and aren't ecumenical councils. So you mentioned being Eastern Orthodox. The Orthodox accept the first seven ecumenical councils, typically, but some don't accept all seven. Some accept an eighth one. Archbishop Callistus Ware of the Eastern Orthodox Church says that there's no way to know for sure how many ecumenical councils are valid. And interestingly, in between the sixth and the seventh one, the East tried to have an ecumenical council, but it was rejected by the Pope and therefore has been rejected by both the East and the West. So as a matter of history, you can't have an ecumenical council without the Pope, but they are different kind of animals. So in Acts 15, you have what's basically an ecumenical council, the Council of Jerusalem. In Galatians 2, which is what you were referring to, Peter doesn't practice what he preaches. He's kind of acting in a discriminatory way against Gentile Christians to avoid scandalizing the Jews, but in a way that treats the Gentile Christians
as second-class citizens. He's not teaching anything false. He's just behaving in an immoral way, and he is properly called out for it by Paul so that his actions reflect what he's teaching.
So that's the first one. So let's go back to you and ask if that one, Jason, satisfies your objection.
That helps greatly. I will definitely dig deeper into Acts with that. I thank you so much.
Okay, but Antioch. Okay, fair enough.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, the question of Antioch, how can the Bishop of Antioch be the Pope?
Right. Well, this is interesting because there are five what are called apostolic sees, Rome, Antioch, Alexandria, Constantinople, and Jerusalem. So Peter lived in Jerusalem and then Antioch and then Rome. His disciple Mark set up the church in Alexandria, and then Constantinople was the second Rome, so it has a Roman connection. So everything is connected to Rome and to Peter. So there are five apostolic sees, but there's only one the apostolic see. Every time you see the apostolic see, even in like ancient writings, it always means Rome. There is always this pride of place. And the question is why? First, do we know Peter went there? Yes, we do. 1 Peter 5, verse 13. Peter writes, "She who is at Babylon greets you." He's writing from Babylon. We know Babylon is one of the terms that the early Christians had for Rome. Interestingly, hardcore fundamentalists will readily grant that. We also know that literal Babylon was in ruin, so there's no way he's meaning this literally at the time. We also know, I mean, just as a matter of archaeology, we've got his skull. It's been carbon dated to the first century. We know that Peter came to Rome. We also know from post-New Testament writings, for example, the first letter of Clement. Now, Clement is the third pope. It goes Peter, then Linus, Linus, Peter, Clement. It's actually, fourth pope, third pope after Peter. He writes in 96 AD to settle a dispute among the Corinthians. So it's interesting here that they don't write to John, the apostle, who's still alive. They write to Clement of Rome, who's the Pope at the time. And so we have a clear instance of a post-Peter Pope acting in a papal way while an apostle is still alive. And John doesn't respond like, "How dare you? This is my job," or like, "What are you doing getting involved in the East?" So we see from history as well that very clearly this is an authority that was with Rome. Otherwise, Jerusalem and Antioch could equally claim because Peter was in both. But Rome is where he was crowned with martyrdom, as the early Christians said.
And Jason, we've got to leave it there because we have to take a break. We'll be right back with more on the papacy and the early church with Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Catholic Answers Live. The only thing missing from today's broadcast is you. Call now with your question.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
How is it possible that God created everything?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a
why
priest?
Why is the Catholic Church so unwilling to
The Catholic Church is too rich.
Catholics worship Mary and are
committed. As far as I'm concerned, all religions are equal.
You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders. Tonight, 11 p.m. Eastern, on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Back to Catholic Answers Live. Hey, I just heard about this and I forgot to mention it to you, but remember we had that Deep in History sale where you could go to shop.catholic.com and buy any of our history stuff at sale prices? Well, it got extended for one day and I didn't realize it. It's still going through today. I said Friday it would close on Sunday. But okay, so if you want to get some history stuff over at shop.catholic.com, just head over there and click on the banner that says Deep in History. There's CDs, there's books, there's DVDs. It's all on sale. If it has to do with history, it's on sale at shop.catholic.com. And we're talking a bit of history right now with our guest, Joe Heschmeyer. As a matter of fact, the history of the papacy in the early church, and your questions are welcome. There are quite a few of them, so I will continue to move through them. Brian, here in California, watching on YouTube Live, you are up next. Brian, your question for Joe Heschmeyer.
How can a pope maintain his office if he teaches heresy?
So I think that question needs more specificity, Brian.
Are you...
Can you hear me all right?
Yeah.
So you're saying there are popes that taught heresy and they kept their office, or are you saying it just in a speculative way, like a pope could teach heresy?
It's more of a question because I read this quote from Pope Adrian VI. He was talking about how many of the pontiffs were heretics. It says, if by the Roman Catholic Church, or Roman Church, you mean the head is, head or pontiff, it is beyond question that he can err in, even in matters touching faith. He does this when he teaches heresy by his judgment or decretal. In truth, many Roman pontiffs were heretics. The last of them was John the 22nd.
Okay.
So what is the source from that Pope Adrian the VI said that?
I think, hold on. I'm not exactly, because I thought,
It doesn't sound familiar to me, that quote. So if you can find it for us, that would be helpful.
Because I can't exactly find the quote. I know it came from the Remnant newspaper, but I don't know where it came from after that.
The Remnant newspaper.
Yeah, I'd have to probably try to trace the quote. If I'm being totally honest with you, I'm a little skeptical about the veracity of the quote, but I can say a little bit about Pope John the 22nd, who's mentioned there, because I think that can be helpful for understanding what we mean and what we don't mean by papal infallibility. So Pope John the 22nd, in a series of homilies that he gave, suggested that when you die, you don't immediately get judged, but you aren't judged until the final judgment. And at first, it sounds like maybe a plausible theory. It was something the church hadn't ever really explicitly defined, but it's incompatible with Catholicism because it means you couldn't pray to the saints. It means the saints aren't currently in heaven. It means, you know, a lot of Catholic praxis would be totally wrong. And all the scriptural parts about death and judgment, it seems inconsistent with that. So we believe in two judgments, what's called individual judgment, where every soul at the moment of death is judged and sent either to heaven or hell. If heaven, they might go through purgatory first, but it's not a third kind of like final destination. And then general judgment when Christ comes again in glory. So Pope John the 22nd kind of waded into some speculative waters in a bad way in a series of private homilies. Now, this is important because he wasn't saying, to be Catholic, you have to agree with me on this. He was offering his thoughts, and his thoughts were wrong. And so the theologians of the University of Paris, which were the greatest Dominicans, especially of the age, quickly explained, respectfully, but they showed where this theory was in error. And the Pope immediately after him dogmatically defined that, in fact, the immediate judgment exists and that John the 22nd's speculations were mistaken. In fact, John the 22nd, before his death, actually retracted them because he was convinced by these theologians' interventions that, like, no, in fact, he had said something wrong. This is important to bear in mind even now. Like, if the Pope says something in, like, an airplane interview, that doesn't make it automatically the teaching of the Catholic Church.
But Joe,
it doesn't make it the kind of thing infallible.
Let me ask you a question then. What about if, let's say, Pope Adrian VI Let's say this quote is legitimate, but it comes from a time before he is pope. Are there popes who said, for example, heretical things before they were pope?
Yeah. St. Peter, for example, said a lot of incorrect things about Jesus before he was pope.
Because sometimes people will do that. They'll give a quote to say, Pope so-and-so said this, but it's a quote from before the time the man was actually pope. And so, as you said, Peter said heretical things before he was a pope. We never claim that popes are infallible from birth or that they don't have heresies, you know, when they're teenagers. Or it's in their authority as the pope, there has never been a pope who taught heresy.
Not in a way that everyone had to agree with. Again, in like John the 22nd in private homilies, but not in a way that like, this is the teaching of the Catholic Church. If you don't agree, you're a heretic, that sort of thing.
Would that satisfy you, Brian? I mean, it's hard for us to, we don't have the quote in front of us and we don't know if it's an authentic quote, but it certainly would be perfectly reasonable to say if it is an authentic quote, you'd have to find out, did he say it as Pope or did he say it before he was Pope or did somebody else say it and it's attributed to him? Would that seem like a fair answer to you, Brian?
I'm just wondering whether if a pope can, I understand sometimes it's like private, it's not always like lais sentiente, it's only when it's on faith and morals and it's binding on the faithful. So I'm kind of having a hard time understanding it. I heard it's practically impossible for a pope to in that situation to teach heresy. It's just kind of hard for me to accept.
Well, it hasn't happened, so that might help you. It has not happened that a pope has officially taught heresy. I'm going to say thanks for the call, Brian, because I want to get to another call. Is that all right with you, Joe, or did you want to add anything before I go to the next call?
Well, the only thing I'd add is something I said before, real quick. Infallibility is not for the sake of the Pope. It's for the sake of us. Like, Peter had all his mistakes, but the Holy Spirit protects his writings and his preaching from error, from heresy, for the sake of those being preached to, so that we know we can trust it, so we know it's ultimately coming from God. Infallibility exists for the same reason for us.
Thanks, Brian, for the call. Let's go to JP in Wheaton, Maryland, listening to EWTN Channel 130 on Sirius Satellite Radio. Your question for Joe.
Yes, sir. I just wondered, could you speak to the legend of a female pope? I was in a...
Pope Joan.
Brought it up in a conversation.
The famous Pope Joan. Was there a Pope Joan, Joe?
There was not a Pope Joan. I think the easiest way to disprove it is the fact that we know the dates of papal succession. We know the details of papal elections. In the words of St. Paul, these things did not happen in a corner. This was like the biggest, most important election in all of Europe throughout the Middle Ages. So there's this claim. So Pope Joan, like the legend says that in the 800s, from 855 to 857, there was a Pope Joan, and this is a medieval story from the 1200s and is totally not just not supported by the historical record, but is directly refuted by the historical record. We know, for example, of Benedict III being there in 1855. There's coins dating from 855 when Pope Joan is allegedly a pope, and it's Benedict III. And then we have like Nicholas I right after that. There's no time for there to be some female pope. And if you actually read the legends about it, they're ridiculous, because the idea is that there's this woman who pretended to be a man and became pope, and then was in the middle of a coronation or in the middle of a papal procession and had a baby, and that's where everyone found out it was a woman.
So
you have
an
extremely pregnant woman pretending to be a man. It's not a very plausible theory.
Okay, well, thank you for getting the question out so quickly, JP, so that we were able to answer it. So no Pope Joan, but we did have Joe Heschmeyer for 2 hours. And Joe, I want to say thank you very much for doing those 2 hours with us.
My pleasure.
And people can find you at shamelesspopery.com. And the other one is called The Catholic Podcast. Very exciting news.
Yes, it is.
Joe, it's always great to have you here. Thanks so much. Hope you get cooled off there. I hope everybody who's been living in the heat gets a little bit of coolness. Don't forget, if you're here in San Diego, Don Eden Goldstein going to be over at Our Lady of the Rosary Parish tonight. And tomorrow, 2 hours of open forum. We'll see you then, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.